Hey there, it's Vicky here from Online Marketing Basics for Busy Website Owners, and welcome to the podcast. In this episode, I'm going to be chatting with Colette Stevenson, who I've had the pleasure of getting to know really well over the past year. And Colette is a branding and kind of colour specialist with a background working with educators. She also lived in Japan for a while and has brought that kind of culture to what she does in her work. Colette is my go-to expert in the Supercharger website membership when it comes to getting an assessment on whether colours work, and the members have always just found her advice invaluable. And we both started a Clubhouse room recently on a Friday morning reviewing people's websites. So you're able to come up, rock up to the stage if you're on Clubhouse and let us know your URL. And then we've both been doing a kind of a quick hit review of your websites to see if it makes sense from a kind of a user experience point of view. I guess that's my kind of input, and Colette brings her branding and kind of color eye to the table. The chat is just so much fun, and we both talk about our backgrounds as non-designers and how we feel like being creative isn't necessarily something that's exclusive to only those who've kind of gone through the education system. I think you'll find it really interesting, and I'll see you at the end of the episode. I'm Vicky Jakes, and in this podcast, I'm aiming to bring you no-nonsense advice on how to drive more traffic to your small business website so that you can start making more money. It will be packed full of hints and tips, jargon free, and a chance for us to geek out together on a weekly basis. So let's crack on with this week's episode. Would you like to tell me a little bit about yourself, Colette, so that everyone who's listening to Online Marketing Basics for Busy Website Owners knows who you are?
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me here. I'm Colette. I'm a graphic designer and brand colour consultant. And it's taken me a long time to use those words confidently to describe myself, because I have been through a varied journey in my life that's always involved some element of creativity. I've worked in theatre, I've worked in education, I've run cafes and so run designed menus and things. And through it all, I always wanted to do what I'm doing today, but didn't feel confident. And so to get to this point where not only am I doing what I love to do, but I'm feeling confident in it and other people are enjoying my work is a pleasure, actually. So
that's awesome. So I love the fact that you've got a varied background. Every creative person I know has some type of creative background as well. Quite surprising, actually, in the agency world, the creatives were the ones, you know, who come up with the ideas for like ads and campaigns and stuff. Mm. And they'd often come from backgrounds of like being labourers or yes. not having gone to university and done a graphic design degree or whatever, right? Because creativity is, you can't label it, can you?
No, it's not linear. It just happens. It's a process rather than something you're taught. It's something you exercise, I think. I think it's something that we all have, but many people are afraid of, including myself, even though I grew up in a very kind of creative way, I suppose, and followed a very creative lifestyle. I was always very afraid of it. Yeah.
What did you used to do as kids then that was quite creative?
We were known as the cardboard box family.
That sounds like my house right now with my children. Yeah, Mummy, don't throw that away. It needs to be junk modelled.
Yes. Yeah, that's
that you.
Yeah, that was me. We just had cardboard boxes. I think maybe because we didn't have much money growing up, they were our toys. But we made spaceships and we went on adventures. We built forests and schools and, you know, explored the world with cardboard boxes. So that was the beginning, I suppose.
And were you quite arty then at school? Did you do quite well at art at school as a subject?
No. No, I wanted to be good at art. I remember being about probably about 5 or 6 years old and I only know that because of the classroom that I was sitting in. And another teacher came into the classroom and held up a piece of artwork done by an older child. And she was like, wow, look at this. And I looked at that artwork and I was like, I want to do that one day. And because I couldn't do it then, I never believed that I could do it. It took me a long time. It took me until I was a grown up to realize that actually it doesn't matter if you can't do something now, you can do it later. It's a process and you don't have to be able to do things the exact same way. But I think as a child, I compared myself a lot to those who could do better than me and never believed myself to be very good. And the teachers were never particularly over enamored by my work either. So that didn't really help.
Oh, nothing like the scorn of a teacher, is there? Honestly, to imprint way into your adult psyche. Yeah. I was very arty as a child.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, really arty. Used to love watching Heartbeat.
Oh, I loved Heartbeat
with Tony Hart.
And yeah, then I sent off a piece of artwork to him.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah. And I remember like my nan would help me make things to send into Heartbeat, and then Rolf's Cartoon Club when it was wholesome.
Yeah.
was a thing as well, but I didn't know that I was artistic until there was an art parents, like an arty parents evening, where they were going to get a bunch of children to put on like a demo. You know, what, in one corner we've got painting, in the other we've got kind of junk modeling, in the other we've got drawing, and they were like, oh, so you'll come and do this? I was like, will I? Yes, because you're quite arty. I'm like, am I? And it was nice having that label put on me, because then I really lent into it and like found that I was genuinely really interested in art and art subjects as I went through high school. And I ended up doing A-level art. I had plans to go to Wimbledon Art College. Wow. I was very inspired by weird conceptual art that I'd seen at the Sensations exhibition that was run by Saatchi in the 90s, and I thought that was it. I thought I was off to go and be a super like beardy weedy artist. and then I discovered film editing, like digital film editing. Someone gave me a copy of Premiere and said, oh, you can like splice clips together, and that was it. I was just like, oh, I'll go and do that.
It was like I discovered Photoshop in the late 90s, and suddenly
a cracked copy, right?
Probably. But suddenly I had an outlet. So whereas I've never had great fine motor skills, I think partly because I have ADHD, and one of the things is this kind of I can't structure my writing well. Because of that, I wasn't very good. And suddenly with Photoshop, although it wasn't Illustrator, I could move color around and lines around, and then it didn't matter so much if they weren't right because I could move it again. And it was that fluidity that I just really loved.
I totally get you there. It's the instantaneous result that you get.
Yes.
Like I said, I went off to do film and study film at university. And so, you know, with that is lots of developing and lighting and all of that. And you might have to wait a while for your rushes to come back. And then you have to actually splice your film together. And then after that, because of that experience, I went to work in Jessop's and helped sell old film cameras, SLR film cameras. And then obviously digital kind of came in, and I was like, oh, Photoshop. Oh, digital cameras. You mean you don't have to like be in a dark room for ages and you can get this instantaneous result? And I loved it so much that that's what got me into web design.
Wow.
Because I loved digital image editing so much. And I was like, oh, you could build websites. And I did a Dreamweaver course and learned and paid, like did a kind of home learning course that I'd seen off the telly. And that's what I did straight after university. I never went into film. I got totally wooed by digital. Despite a lecturer at university saying, don't get wooed by digital, I got totally wooed.
No, don't get wooed by digital.
What kind of path did you go through then, kind of through school and then into career?
If I went into theatre, so I was always labelled as musical because I could play anything. It was a strange thing. I could play anything. I couldn't read music, but I could play it on pretty much any instrument. So people labelled me as musical, but not my teachers. See, my teachers were quite reluctant to nurture that, should we say. So as much as I tried to get onto music courses and I tried to join the school orchestra and I tried to study music at GCSE level, it just was not a strong suit of my school at that time. So I switched to drama, which was quite a good move for me because I was a very, very shy person and I struggled with one-to-one interactions. And then on stage, I had a structure where I could find my voice and I could talk to people and I could be confident. And I thought, wow, if I can do it on stage, I can do it in real life. And that kind of propelled me forward in a way from that point. So I was going to go off to, I got a place in Central School of Speech and Drama. And I was like, right, I'm going to go and go to London and study drama. And I can't remember what happened, but I think I bottled it. And so I just didn't go, and I went off and did youth work for a while and worked in retail and pottered around for a few years before finally going off to study drama in Newcastle. And then I did go into acting for a while, and I did lots of stage design, and I worked in lighting design and costume design, and I did directing. Mostly I enjoyed performing. And that was kind of the direction I was going in. Until I went to Japan. I thought, well, I'll go off, sort out my life for a year. I've always wanted to live abroad. So I'll go off, teach English for a year and come back. And if I like teaching, maybe I'll come back and be a teacher. And it was kind of my get out of jail free card was I'll be a teacher. And I went off and I loved my work over there. And it was really, really fast-paced teaching. I mean, it was fast food English lessons, basically. You had students coming in to do a 40-minute lesson to learn English, and you had 10 minutes in between lessons. You pull the files, check what they'd studied before, plan a lesson, go in, teach them for 40 minutes, go back off and repeat. So you constantly had to be thinking of new ideas and making new resources, and it was absolutely brilliant for me. Suddenly I was making resources all the time. I ended up somehow running 11 schools and doing training all over Tokyo.
Wow.
Karma. And it was absolute, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then I went independent and again, just continued developing resources, making resources, writing children's books, all kinds of stuff. I had a really, really fun time, opened my own school. And I was just, I felt like I was on fire because I just had, you know, work coming in and I was creating the whole time. And I remember I used to go to Starbucks until 11 o'clock at night to develop resources and make images and things. And I used to sit there thinking, God, imagine if I could just do this for a living.
Was that your favorite bit then?
That was my favorite bit. And I met this guy. He runs a website called I Love Typography. I met this guy in the coffee shop, and I was like, oh, so what do you, he used to always come and he'd be on his computer. And I said, so what do you do? And he'd say, oh, you know, I blog. And I was like, what do you mean you blog? And he was the first person I'd ever met who made a living digitally and then just traveled the world. And I was like, oh, you blog? What do you blog about? And he said, fonts. I was like, what? My world opened in that instant. And I used to meet him most nights and he'd talk about fonts and I'd talk about colors and it was magic. And then he went off and lived in Vietnam and I just carried on with my life thinking one day I want to do work just online making pictures.
Oh my Lord, you're ringing my nerd bell here because I love typography. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I loved typography. Actually, I didn't know I loved graphic design because I went in after university, I had to make money. So I went into sales, publishing sales. I was like, well, I love magazines. I'll go and sell ads in the back of them.
And ads, yeah.
I sold ads in the back of the Engineer magazine, Sexy Times. And then they were like, well, you're quite techie. This is like 2002, 2003. You're quite techie. We've got a new directory website, back when directory websites were a strategic way to drive more traffic. Mm. Because if you could get someone to pay to be on a high ranking website, they could like steal some of that domain authority back before Google got really smart, right? So I would sell directory listings to subcontract engineer companies. No. So I'd be ringing Brian, who was the MD of this company, but Brian would be on the shop floor. So I'd have to ring Jean, who would have to go, Brian, it's someone from A4 Subcon who wants to sell you some banners and buttons. What? Banners and buttons. I'll come over. And you have to wait 5 minutes for Brian to come across the shop floor and then answer the phone. And then I'd have to school Brian on what a website was. Brian, do you want to, you're already in our printed directory that goes out every year. Would you like to be in the website as well? Well, what's a website? What do I want to be on that for? And we used to sell these listings for 50 quid each.
Oh my 50 God. Quid each.
And that was like, that was hard. But at the same publishing company, I had my eye on this. I was like, one day I'm going to get a job at Creative Review. It was such a beautiful book. I don't know if you've ever read it as a magazine.
But no.
It's the go-to magazine Bible, if you like, for the creative industry. So you'd always have a copy on your reception table, you know, when clients come in and stuff. It's like one of those big, beautiful, thick magazines with glossy pictures. But of creative advertising projects, of packaging, of design, of art, of everything that's commercial, right? And I got a job with them. And I wangled a job with them. And in the 2-3 years that I was there, I read every single copy. I got to know the agencies really well. I studied everything so I could go out and talk to my clients. And they gave me typography companies. See if you can get them to advertise, Vicky. Because they're not advertising anymore. They don't want to spend any money with us. So I would go out, do the rounds, and go meet some amazing artists, like graphic designers. And I learned all about typography. I was even down at Dalton Marg Studio meeting the creator of Comic Sans. And he's like, you're not allowed to joke about it. So I love typography, but it's really interesting, right, is that you had like a real interest in making, like you had a compulsion from the sounds of it, after you kind of got to Japan, to kind of just create for the sake of creating. And I hear you on that front. I've always had a compulsion to make something. I've done blogging, whether it's photography, writing, just to be immersed in creativity. Yes. Is what gets me out of bed every morning.
That's it. It's that whole, it's just desire to make. And people say, what do you do? I'm a maker. I'm not, you know, when I say I'm a graphic designer or a color consultant, that doesn't really encapsulate it. I make things. I don't follow recipes. I invent recipes. I make stuff. I love it. I love that process of creating something where there was nothing before, of filling a space, whether it's a physical space or whether it's time, with something that was, you know, only imagined. And I love the process of going from having no clue whatsoever about what's going to happen to creating something and making something that people connect to or relate to or enjoy in some way. I think that's magic.
I would say this though, right? As someone who's always been a maker and I was really interested in creativity, I still carried on doing digital making in the evening. So I was like you, I'd be up till like midnight.
Yeah.
Making stuff, making animations, GIFs, still making websites. And then I got a job at another company after Creative Review, helping them make assets for their marketing. And then after that, I got to go and work for EMAP, being a project manager, making digital advertising assets for some of their big titles like FHM and Kiss and More Magazine and Heat Magazine. And as soon as you start doing it for a living, it kind of changes it. I was a project manager, right? So I'd be overseeing creative people, you know, designers, developers, copywriters and stuff. It definitely lost some of its shine for a bit.
I think it does, not now, because now I work, it's me and it's my relationship with a client. So it's still very free. I'm not following somebody else's guidelines. And I think one of the things I always struggled with was that although I design, there's all these rules about design that you're supposed to follow. And I'm not really, I didn't study design.
I did,
but in my own way. I read and I experimented and I explored. But you see, I've taken that creative path where you just experiment rather than plan. So I think if you're working for somebody else, they want to see the plan, they want to see the process, they want to see something tangible, they want to know what you're working towards, and that stifles creativity, or at least it does for me.
I couldn't agree more. I spent so many years in kind of the project management space watching my plans that I would create fall apart, not because of my bad plan making, but because there's so many more things to consider when rolling out big websites, right? And you do have to add in a level of experimentation and flexibility into a plan. And I didn't realize that method of project management had a name. It was called Agile, and it was being rolled out in Silicon Valley, right? I didn't know this. And then I read something about it in 2011 and went to a big conference called South by Southwest the next year. And I was like, my total world changed when I realized that you could come together with people, make stuff, ship it, get the results back. If it wasn't great, you'd do it again. And no one would get penalized because the perfect plan wasn't rolled out. And that applies to creative elements as well. And so I followed a path and became a Scrum Master and specifically wanted to work in kind of that style of creating websites in particular, because I did a few apps, but it was like mainly websites and platforms that I worked on. But I always felt very constrained, even as a project manager, by plans. And it's interesting you said, like, I didn't study design. I didn't either, right? But I feel like I am an authority on what I think works when it comes to something being creative or not. In the same way, yes, that at the beginning of this convo, when I mentioned, like, creative agencies quite often are headed up by two blokes who were friends at school, never went to university, but they were just really good at coming up with ideas. I think you can learn creativity. You can train your eye to see what's creative without having to go and do a 3-year degree.
You can totally. I totally agree. I mean, I've made some really, really bad designs in my time.
Me too.
But that's how I've learned. I'm looking at it and I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. And I'm so embarrassed by it. And it's easy to let yourself think that then is your identity. Oh, I can't do it. But actually, it's just part of that journey. It's part of that learning. It's looking at, okay, well, why isn't that working? Why does it look so bad? And starting again. And also, I can look back at work that I have done. And I used to think it was brilliant. And I look at it now and I'm like, it wasn't at all. It was okay. It was brilliant for what I could do at that time.
Now I've worked with many designers over the years, graphic designers who specialize specifically in kind of online asset creation. And you know, if any of them are listening to this, I'm sure you're nodding and will agree, but there's an element of perfection when it comes to creating a design. And then someone who's was often an agency in the middle of having to translate those designs from the designer to a client, is they're having to say, well, the client needs this for their brand, but the designer would then push back and be like, yes, but I feel that this is what's going to work for the design, right? So yeah, I understand where you're coming from with your amazing degree and your experience and you're following the golden triangle and all of this stuff, but the client, just to be happy, wants the logo 50 pixels to the left. Please, can we just put it 50 pixels to the left and then we can close the project? Everyone will sign it off. No one's going to notice your logo being 50 pixels to the left. We'll all be fine. So there was always that, right? But there are just some things that I think when you're looking at a website, right, in particular, that it's pretty obvious when it's not good design.
Yes.
And making mistakes.
Yeah.
Right. So I think like elements too close together is always a telltale sign. I love white space and I talk about it a lot on the podcast. What are things that you see again and again on kind of websites in particular when it comes to design?
The space thing is definitely an issue. I remember learning about space when I was working at the newspaper doing advertising, and that was what, back in 2000, the year 2000, and that was the first time I realized that space, negative space and positive space, were things that could be designed and played with. And learning that then opened my eyes to so much more. And when I go onto a website and it's cluttered, or there's big blocks of color with low contrast, or the colors that kind of attack you,
anything that's magenta or cyan, you know, like original 8-bit colors,
yes, yeah, it just looks cheap, but it doesn't work, at least not now. And I know people talk about, you know, design trends and that kind of thing, but there's also aesthetics, and aesthetics never change.
What's the difference between like design trends or design then and aesthetics?
Right. So a design trend, it's like fashion. So right now there is a trend for kind of high vibrant gradients. For whatever reason, people are pushing kind of bright gradients and putting them in logos and putting them in background, and people are including them in all kinds of things. But the problem is gradients don't translate well when shrunk down to a tiny size. they don't work well for a long term, so they don't have any longevity. So even though it's a design trend and you can do it well, aesthetically it doesn't have that thing where people can look at it and just feel, not think about it. So if you see a tree against a blue sky, you know that it looks nice, and you don't know why. You don't think about it. You probably don't even notice it. But if you go on, you know, if you go onto a website and you see a bright pink tree with a gradient that goes down to some kind of weird yellow.
what I'm enjoying, right, and people can't see this because we're chatting on Zoom, but as you're describing how you like the color, you're physically feeling it. Like,
yeah, and
that's something to sort of take into account, is that design trends, as you know, are like, yeah, like a fashion of something, like flat 2D is a trend, isn't
yes,
it? Like,
yeah,
but the aesthetic would be if you were high contrasting or doing something that makes you look like you just did then, which is wince.
Yeah. I wince a lot. I do. There are just some elements of design that just don't work.
Right. And so this is the thing. If a design makes you think too much about how to interact with it, it's not a good design.
That's it.
Essentially, I think this, I just mentioned the flat design trend just then. That sort of came in to the kind of design consciousness online, I feel, around kind of 2014, 2015. It was definitely like a backlash against the 3D button,
yeah,
drop shadow nastiness, perhaps, of, you know, web version one.
Yeah. And I did try those on my websites then too.
Didn't we all? I used to have a library of buttons, like beveled, embossed, you know, so yeah, with drop shadows, just so they look like a button when you click them, they animated. I did all of that, had all of my flash buttons, all of that. But I really liked the flat design, and I think Apple were the ones who just put their foot down and said, like, this is happening. App icons are going to be flat. We're going to move to this flat style, and then kind of everyone followed suit. And it's not necessarily a trend, it's because it's related to how you absorb, yeah, at the aesthetic level, exactly. Yeah. It relates to how you absorb the information. So this is why we don't see animated banners like I used to sell on the Engineer magazine on websites anymore. And like, that's what we used to make, these flash banners with crazy things. Oh yeah, no one looks at them anymore. It's called banner blindness, when we physically don't raise our eyes up when we look at a web page, because we know we're being sold to in that space. And this is why they don't exist anymore. They're a kind of a busy distraction. that time's gone, because we're so overwhelmed with information online now. If you've got something to say that's really important, you need to make it as easily digestible, as easily absorbed as possible. And that is with great aesthetics, right?
Yeah, you've got to remove the noise, remove the noise. I mean, I think one of the biggest tips I give to any clients I work with now is just take away any flourishes. I don't care if you love it. If it's not serving a purpose, take it away. Borders or little swishes, or just little, sometimes people will just put little things on because they like it, and I understand why they like it, but it's not actually directing the reader's attention to anything in particular.
You know what you've made me just remember is reviewing someone's site recently, and they had decided to move their menu, so it's running down the right hand side, like vertically, of the desktop view of their website. And so as soon as I land on the website, my eye goes up to the top left to look for the menu and the logo, but it's not there. Oh, okay, so that subconscious movement has already been disrupted. And I'm like, oh, okay, I've got to work. I just wanted to find out the thing about the thing I'd Googled. Okay. So then I'm having to like scan across the top, my eyes going left to right, because you know, I'm from the UK. It's how I read. Oh, there's no menu up there. Oh, well, where's the menu? Looking all around the page. We're already 3 seconds into this experience, but it matters, right? Because yes, my brain has been disrupted. The behaviors, the inherent behaviors, the subconscious behaviors have been stopped. So I scan down the right-hand side and I'm like, oh, there's a menu. But she's not got anything in order. It's homes at the bottom. Well, I don't feel that the home should be at the top. And I said, well, look, before I carry on and do the rest of like the review here, what we've got is an issue, because I'm having to try and find where everything is on your site. I'm bored, I'm going to go somewhere else. Yeah. And that's how, whether we like that or not, we have to impress in 50 milliseconds or less, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter what we like, actually, in that case. We have to just go with how people are perceiving what you're putting out in the world.
Totally. That decisive approach to design, like I hear it quite a lot. But when I start working with new clients, when people come into the membership or the challenge, right, I hear that, well, I don't like it, so I don't have it on my site. Well, I don't use the internet like that, so I'm not going to do that. Well, I don't like Facebook, so I don't think. Like,
you're not using your site, other people are.
It doesn't matter about you. Your website is not for you. Your marketing is not for you. Yeah. Unless you are your exact ideal customer, then brilliant, well done. Like, you really do know your market. But most of the time, we're not selling to people like us. You know, we are selling to like sectors that we perhaps don't know that much about. But to assume is to possibly limit the reach that you can have with your website, and actually the reach with your marketing online in general. Let's go down the road of really bad design. When have you seen a really bad design? What kind of made you go, oh my God?
I did see one recently. Nothing was aligned. So the first thing that happened was there was this solid block of color, and then in the middle of the, I was looking at it on my desktop, so there was this solid banner across the top, and then in the middle part there was another banner that was the same color but a different shade, but not aligned. It was like shifted off to the right somewhere, and then below that there was something else, and through it all the text was center aligned. But it went, so it kind of zigzagged. There was no flow. So you had to start, when you went on the site, you had to start looking at kind of this top right area to find out what the site was about. But at the whole time, you had this wall of a really, really bright color attacking you. And then to find the next piece of information, you had to move. You couldn't just scroll down. You had to scroll down and then move to the left. And then you had to scroll down and move to the right again. If your text is left aligned, people know where it starts, right? Especially if you've got a long block of text or a paragraph. And I think what people sometimes do is they'll put these big blocks of text and center align it. And then they'll do the same somewhere else. But because it's on a different position on the website, so it goes from the right side to the left side to the right side again, using that column structure, because nothing's aligned, nobody can find the beginning of the text.
What you're talking about is, again, user behavior. It's like dialing straight into making absorbing that content as easy as possible for the user.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a block of text on the right or a block on the left, but keep it left aligned, especially if it's a long paragraph, because then people can see that start point and then they go to the next block and it should be about something different, not continuing from the other point. It's just that whole flow. It is about finding flow. If you think of a website as kind of a river and you just kind of, it's, or a stream, and you're just kind of following that river, and it might go round bends or it might fork off in other directions or whatever, but it's always flowing from this one point and it's always going to one point as well. So if you don't have that kind of flow in your design and you put big rocks in the middle, and it's really distracting. People can't find their way. And I'll be really honest, I'm very, very lazy on the internet. If I go on a website and I don't like looking at it, I just click off. There might be like really great nuggets. There might be amazing value. There might be something there I really want to buy. But if I have to look at something that hurts my eyes, or if I have to work too hard to find what I'm looking for, I'll just go somewhere else.
One of the websites I like bringing out and showing the members of the Supercharged website membership is, it's been rated one of the worst websites in the world by Reddit users, and it's called arngren.net. It's a Norwegian classified site,
I
believe.
I'm going to have to look at it.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes, but I'm going to just show you the website now, Colette, and
okay,
then just get your reaction to this. So are you ready for arngren.net?
Yeah.
Here you go.
I don't know if I am. Oh, no. Oh, my gosh.
How do you feel about this website?
Oh, my God. I feel like I'm reading an old newspaper from, like, you know, years ago, but it's been really badly done, like an old classified newspaper. I mean, how does anybody find anything there? It's a jumble sale.
Just to sort of describe this, because obviously you're listening, out there, guys, is that this has a roundabout running down the left-hand side, I'd say like 40 text links, all in different colours. So already, like, I can see Colette's eye twitching there. And then we have, like, I would say approximately 100 panels of products that are being sold on this site, like cars and electric scooters and bikes. But they're not aligned. Like, every single box has got different outline thicknesses. They're not aligned with the next one. The links are all just like HTML links. So I don't know if they go to somewhere, if I'm meant to click them. And it is just the most incredibly busy circa 1998 website you have ever seen. And it's still live. It's still running.
My goodness. Do you know what? I mean, if you ever wanted to know what not to do, this gives you everything, doesn't it? I mean, it gives you everything. I mean, some boxes have no borders at all. Some have really thick ones. Some have really thin ones. The only thing that seems to be aligned is that middle panel in yellow, which I don't even know why it's yellow. It doesn't make any sense.
Right, because using a colour would denote a theme of a website,
yeah,
right?
Or
a signal.
Like, yeah, this is it looks like that's where you're supposed to focus, this kind of middle panel. It's like, this is the really important information, but I didn't see anything really important there at all.
No, not at all. I'm going to stop sharing that because I don't want to give you heart palpitations. So quite amusingly, this is not to this extreme, but we're doing this every Friday on Clubhouse at the moment, aren't we? Where we're basically asking people to rock up with their websites, which, by the way, have all been very pleasant so far, and not as terrifying as arngren.net, and asking people to submit their website to us, and then we do a review on Clubhouse. Well, look, do you want to just explain to everyone what Clubhouse is in your words, what you think it is? Because some of the people listening are like, what's Clubhouse, guys?
It's the newest social media platform, and it's audio based and nothing's recorded. So it's basically a podcast like this, and on a Friday Vicky and I chat, but you can join in, so you can actually chat with us, which is quite cool because we get to chat with you too. I heard somebody describe it as citizens radio, which I quite like. Ooh. Because but everybody has input, but you're not obligated to input. You can just sit and listen and enjoy it, which I often do. I often just listen to conversations, but occasionally I might want to ask a question. You can meet people who have a wealth of information that you would never normally be able to access, and you can just talk and get some one-on-one advice just very, very easily. I find it to be a really, really fascinating platform that I'm still, to be honest, finding my way around and having to really make sure I don't lose my whole day.
Yeah, because it's pretty much just taken off since Christmas time. Like, the app's been going since like early 2020. They had a lot of funding from the Silicon Valley type. I definitely describe it like live podcasting, like live unedited podcasting. And the premise is that people come into a room and people host a room, like Colette and I do with our Clubhouse, like a website review session on a Friday morning. And you can invite people to talk. So it's not like you go into a room and then everyone can talk at once. So Gary Vee described it as like having people around a table, right? And then if people want to come and stand behind and listen to this conversation, they can. And then the speakers can choose to invite people to speak on the table. And there seems to be a self-regulated a kind of culture and etiquette that's kind of come out about how people come up on the stage, as it's been dubbed, and, you know, not selling yourself and kind of ensuring that you don't talk over each other. I mean, I have been in some Clubhouse rooms where it's just been like a total bun fight. And Elon Musk was in Clubhouse last week, totally broke the entire platform. Yeah. And everyone wanted to get into that room, but it was a 5,000 limit. And then there were overflow rooms of people listening to it on their phone and then broadcasting it to other people. Just really crazy. But what that's done is kind of get that to the national press and everything. But I heard that some woman in the Elon Musk chat just talked over Elon Musk. There you go, you can do that. But the thing is, there's nowhere to chat, there's nowhere to like. So it's just all audio. So when we're doing our website review sessions, which I think is the only type of website review session, it's the only type of room like this I've seen so far on Clubhouse.
Yeah, I've not seen any others like it.
Yeah, because there's a lot of marketing chat on there about how do you use Clubhouse, right? And there's lots of rooms named like that, or people talking conceptually about their business. But we're actually saying, right, tell us what your website link is. We'll all in the room open up the website together, and then Colette and I will review it. Me from a sort of a website optimization user experience point of view, you from a kind of design and branding point of view. And I didn't think anyone would be up for it, Colette.
No, I was very nervous that first one. I had no idea what we were doing, why we were doing it, who would come, and how on earth we'd talk about websites on an audio platform. I was quite anxious about it.
It's wet though, hasn't it?
But you've made a really good point, because people can't comment or type in things. So it's not, you know, you're not doing it for likes, but people stay and listen. And to me, that is the biggest compliment ever, actually. Not compliment, it's the wrong word. The biggest...
Endorsement,
that's the word. You know you're helping people. You know that you're supporting people. You know that you're giving value to people, not because you're getting a quick like and people scroll on by or they say, good post. People stay and listen, and then that gives you information about the kind of content that you can keep creating. And I really, really like that.
I love that. And I've been in some rooms with some really high profile entrepreneur types who have given out value that I suspect is available in their very expensive courses. And I'm like, I'm sat here listening to this for free on Clubhouse. Yeah. If you want to join Clubhouse, it is iPhone only. Apparently they're going to roll out the Android version in the next couple of months, and it's invite only. So you're going to have to find someone who can bring you in. That's how these Silicon Valley types do it, in order to create FOMO. And FOMO, they have So let's wind this up, Colette. Okay. Then thank you very much for joining me and coming to chat about your background, about creativity, about kind of just design in general. I mean, I've really, really enjoyed this chat, like genuinely.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. I've really had a fun time.
And if you want to come and get your website reviewed by Colette or myself, then come and join us on Clubhouse this Friday at 10 a.m. You can search for me, just Hey Vicky Jakes. I'll be on there. We'll post it up on the Facebooks, the Instagrams. And if you're on my email list, I will be emailing you and letting you know about this. And this week, I'm really interested to know if you've got a sales page that needs reviewing, because Colette and I would love to see if you're selling your thing correctly and if it looks nice. Hello, I'm back. Did you enjoy that episode? It was a lot of fun to record, and I'm hoping what you got from my chat with Colette was, a little bit of insight into the background of someone who's creative. Found out a little bit more about me, but also more importantly, you kind of heard what we thought about bad website design and like the common things that we see come up again and again. Like if you recall from listening, like white space, alignment, making sure something doesn't jar the user when they look at it or jolt them out of a subconscious behavior. These things are really important when it comes to laying out your offer on your websites or your landing pages. And sometimes we spend far too long looking at those things and can't see the wood for the trees. So this is why we're doing the website review sessions. It's why this week in the Supercharged Website membership, I've been doing landing page and sales page reviews. It just helps having someone else with an expert eye to look at your stuff. If you are keen to get my help reviewing your landing page or your sales page, then I have got an offer on at the moment. So feel free to find me via Hey Vicky Jakes on Instagram or heyvickyjakes.com via my website to learn more. I'd love to hear from you and see if I can help. I will see you in the next episode very soon.